Okay. When Charles King first wrote to me about doing a talk on the Pulitzer Prize in music, one of the things that immediately attracted me to it was that I couldn't think of where I have ever seen a listing of all of the Pulitzer Prize winners in music. And a couple of weeks ago, I got a copy of a book that I'm going to be reviewing in the column that'll be coming up that Variety has put out, that lists all of the award winners as well as the nominees for the Grammys, the Emmys, the Oscars, and they include one page of Pulitzer Prize plays. They didn't bother to include the Pulitzer Prize music in that book.
Charles King has recently served as assistant music librarian at the University of Arizona in Tucson and has taught string and orchestra in Michigan schools for several years and had done his work at Western Michigan University and the American Conservatory in Chicago. So here now is Charles King.
Doing this right.
Okay.
To answer your question, the Pulitzer winners are in the almanac, not the Farmer's Almanac, but the other almanac.
Oh, like World Almanac?
Yeah. Okay, why the Pulitzer? Because I couldn't find any evidence that anyone else is making a systematic collection of these, or if they are, could they be available to students in our university? I wish to begin this presentation, and hopefully to make a valid point, with a brief medley of those Pulitzer winners which have found a comfortable and permanent place in the repertoire of American concert life. In other words, the works that have passed the toughest test of all, public acceptance. Perhaps you'll be kind enough to participate by raising your hand to indicate recognition and be willing to identify the selection just played. I promise not to work you too hard. Is that the white?
Yeah.
This may be louder than the others. About that one? Very good. Let's go ahead. That one? Very good. I think that's enough to make a small point. But is this too narrow an assessment of these winners? Should I have included these? Anybody want to try that one? Consul is right. Okay. Or maybe this one. For that one? Thank you very much. Oh, I read recently that this one is firmly established in the repertory. Toe-tapping number? Thank you. Okay. In planning how best to present this topic to you, I quickly rejected the idea of playing 1 minute and a few seconds of each of the 39 winners in favor of telling a little about their successes and failures. As time permits, I'd like to play for you some of the music that you're least likely to be enjoying at home, in the concert hall, or in your favorite record store. The Pulitzer Prize is and remains a journalism prize. Joseph Pulitzer believed that the press to be the most potent force for good or evil in civilization and deplored the lack of a journalism school in any American university. From a philanthropic concept which he called the Grand Scheme, Pulitzer ultimately persuaded Columbia University to establish the first journalism school in America with a large gift of $2 million, and almost as an afterthought, included funds set aside for annual awards for excellence in several categories, in which he specified only two or three, such as accuracy in reporting. So concerned was Pulitzer with his journalism school that under the terms of his will, no awards could be given until the trustees at Columbia could show evidence that the journalism school had functioned successfully for 3 years. The passage of time has seen the journalism school at Columbia become simply another component of Columbia's academic programs, while the prizes have developed a life of their own. It is the prizes that have kept the name Pulitzer in the public consciousness and that have become the prestigious awards in journalism and letters. Today, it is mind-boggling to think of erecting a building in Manhattan, endowing a new academic program in a major university, and funding what has become the annual Pulitzer Prizes, this year awarded in 21 categories for just $2 million. In the period from about 1903 to 1917, a buck could really buy a lot, even in New York. In fact, so much in the public consciousness is the name Pulitzer that it comes as a surprise to learn that Joseph Pulitzer arrived as far back as 1865 as a penniless immigrant from Hungary, speaking almost no English, and who lied about his age in order to serve in the Union Army for the last 6 months of the Civil War. It would be easy to spend the remainder of my allotted time discussing this extraordinary man who contributed so much to American public life and to journalism in particular. I shall try to restrict my remarks to some aspects of the Pulitzer story that relate directly to the prizes. Joseph Pulitzer's extraordinary rise to wealth and fame was severely tempered by his equally rapid decline in health to an extreme nervous condition coupled with virtual blindness. It was only by the sheer strength of his enormous will and intellect that he was able to exercise a tyrannical control over his newspaper enterprise, his family, and his long-suffering personal staff. In the early years of the new century, Pulitzer sensed that his grand scheme had to be put into motion before time ran out on his declining health. Perhaps his idealistic nature was further stimulated by the Swedish inventor Albert Nobel, who had only lately established his now famous awards in Europe. Nevertheless, a lengthy period of stormy negotiations took place between the immovable object, Nicholas Murray Butler, president of Columbia, and the irresistible fourth, Joseph Pulitzer himself. If in our own time, presidents of private universities usually experience considerably less difficulty in accepting gifts of $2 million or more dollars, it must be remembered that in 1903, journalism was considered not quite respectable enough to be considered an academic discipline, and President Butler and the trustees worried that the university's reputation might suffer. Predictably, Pulitzer prevailed and the School of Journalism was established. Thus it was on May 24, 1917, that the first awards were decided upon, just 6 weeks after the nation had declared war on Germany, a nation that could not have cared less about some new journalism awards at Columbia. Joseph Pulitzer was passionately fond of music. He made no secret that his favorite composers were Beethoven, Wagner, and Liszt. Nevertheless, Pulitzer was convinced that the state of American musical composition during his lifetime was not sufficiently developed to merit annual awards on the same level as drama, literature, and journalism. Instead, funds were provided for scholarships in music, which continued until 1942. Finally, in 1943, on the recommendation of Douglas Moore, professor of music at Columbia, the music scholarships were converted to an annual prize in music. Thus, 26 years after the first Pulitzer Award, and 32 years after the death of Joseph Pulitzer in 1911, the first Pulitzer Prize in music was awarded to William Schumann for his free song for chorus and orchestra to a patriotic text by Walt Whitman. Again, as in 1917, to a nation totally mobilized for major wars on two fronts, a Pulitzer Award for serious composers working in the larger forms of music was not the message the nation eagerly awaited. Critics of the Pulitzer Prize would say that even the first award was for an atypical work, barely long enough to call a larger form, that has had few performances and to this day no satisfactory recording. The unsatisfactory excerpt which follows is from the initial performance by Koussevitzky, the Harvard Radcliffe Choral Society, and the Boston Symphony.
You live from your atmospheric holy.
it stands today, Schumann is both the first and last recipient of Pulitzer honors, having received a special citation in 1985. Predictably, the first awards went to establishment composers. Even young Schumann had been recognized the preceding year by the New York Critics Circle for his Third Symphony, which made him something less than a risky choice. This in turn to be followed by Howard Hanson, Walter Piston, even Charles Ives for his Third Symphony written many years before, and of course, Aaron Copland. Only slightly more adventurous was the first and only thus far film score by Virgil Thompson, his Louisiana Story. We turn now to what may be the most curious and certainly the most obscure winner. Douglas Moore, whose Giants in the Earth was performed only once at Columbia's Opera Workshop. 23 years later, it was revised and performed at the University of North Dakota, from which I obtained this tape. But what of the original performance? What changes were made in the revision of this unpublished score? I have learned from Columbia's music librarian that there are tapes marked incomplete and which are said to be unplayable in their present state. Nevertheless, while the rest of the world continues to perform and enjoy the Ballad of Baby Doe, we shall hear portions of the one-time-only Pulitzer winner in its revised format. Giants is, of course, based on the novel by Roald Vaag and concerns the settlement of the Dakota Territory by Norwegian immigrants with its hardships and loneliness. In the finale of Act One, which we will hear, the new arrivals are Per Hansa and his wife Berit and their children. Berit is frightened and determined that the family should return to Norway. Her husband and new friends try to comfort her. Ultimately, Berit's inability to adjust to this new life leads to the final tragedy of the story.
No, you killed him.
No, we didn't.
didn't kill anybody yet. He died around here. Graves are all around here.
A burying place.
A regular boneyard. Bones are good for the soil. They help our crops. What's wrong? We didn't kill him.
Have you no respect for the dead? How you have changed since leaving Norwegia.
We haven't changed at all. It's our life here.
Our life here. Our life. No, no. See that? You don't know.
Barrett's girl, it's not as bad as all that.
What are you doing?
We can't stay. I told you we can't stay.
Barrett, Barrett, listen to me.
No, we can't stay. They become like animals here. The devil has taken over. Aren't you afraid?
what you've been missing all these years? The mechanics of the music awards are deceptively simple. Under the terms of Joseph Pulitzer's will, an advisory board consisting of distinguished journalists delivers his recommendations to Columbia's trustees, who accept or reject but may not alter the choices and who make the $1,000 awards. The advisory board in turn appoints a committee of jurors, usually three, to actually screen, narrow down, and recommend winners. The music award must be performed for the first time between March of the previous year and March of the award year. Over the years, some changes and adjustments have been made. As recently as 1975, the trustees were relieved of their largely rubber stamp role, and the awards are now made by the president of Columbia on behalf of the faculty, with the final decisions being made solely by the advisory board. The awards are announced in late April. It may not be generally known that nominations to be considered by the jury may come from any source. A Pulitzer Prize office is maintained in Columbia's Journalism Building for administration and liaison with the working juries. A nomination must be submitted on official forms provided for this purpose, and there's a $20 entry fee. Although anyone may submit an entry, the actual nominations usually come from publishers and artist managements. So much for the rules. The actual mechanics of jury selection may not inspire total confidence in the system. Working from tapes and scores, the jury of three works over one long weekend and comes up with a selection from as many as 100 scores. The identity of the composers is not concealed from the jury. Juries now consist entirely of composers, often former winners. In the past, criticism has challenged the competency of music critics and journalists who served on some early juries to evaluate complex scores adequately and quickly. It must be said, in all fairness, that the life of a prize giver is not an easy one. If evidence of the hazards of picking winners is needed, there's plenty. In 1923, the first musical to win the Drama Award, Of Thee I Sing, carefully avoided any mention of composer George Gershwin, the award going to Ira Gershwin and George Kaufman for the play. The furor surrounding the failure to select Lillian Hellman's play, The Children's Hour, as the drama winner in 1935 led to the formation of the New York Critics Circle that same year, who were confident that they could do a much better job than the Pulitzer juries. The following year, in 1936, both the Pulitzer and Critics Circle failed to pick George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, surely an American winner, whatever the year. The only serious conflict over the music awards arose in 1965. After making no award in 64, the jury decided to withhold the award the second time, but recommended Duke Ellington for a special citation for his contribution to jazz. The advisory board turned down Ellington, but not without considerable rancor between jurors and the board. Following this incident, a new period followed in which the music juries became far more adventurous, with electronic works by Leon Kirshner, Charles Warren, and Mario Davidovsky, as well as such complex works as Elliot Carter's Second Quartet and Donald Martino's Nocturno taking the honors. The last decade of awards has vacillated between more accessible works, such as those by Ellen Zwillich, David Del Tredici, or Dominic Argento, and more difficult scores by Richard Wernick, Roger Sessions, and Bernard Renz. Conspicuously absent as both winners or as jurors are today's minimalist composers. Only time will tell if this movement will produce a winner. two Americans in the former group, Dominic Argento and Ned Roram, who have enjoyed better than average success as composers, both have Pulitzer winners that have been largely ignored, or at least underplayed, and have never been recorded. Ned Roram, best known for his songs, has had little success with his 25-minute-long orchestral variations called air music. Similarly, Dame Janet Baker never followed up her premier performance of Argento's From the Diary of Virginia Woolf with a recording. Here now is the first song. Now a word about the jurors, who in the specialized areas of music and poetry actually pick the winners, though technically the advisory board picks from their recommendations. Over the years, the music juries have included many distinguished names in American music. Early jurors consisted of men like Otto Luening, Henry Cowell, Norman Lockwood, and for 17 consecutive years as chairman, Chalmers Clifton from Columbia's music faculty. In the turbulent middle period, newsman and critic proved perhaps less successful but far more adventurous than their predecessors. Winthrop Sargent from New Yorker, Thomas Sherman from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Ralph McGill of Atlanta Constitution each served as music jurors. In addition, there have been other jurors like Vincent Persichetti and Gunther Schuller in the role of always a bridesmaid, never a bride. And a long list of past winners from Copeland and Ward to recent winners such as Wernick and Warnin. After 40 years, what conclusions can be drawn about the music awards? As your handout indicates, the Pulitzers have done reasonably well in getting both published and recorded, although this cannot be taken for granted and gaps remain to be filled. As a means to wealth and fame, the Pulitzer is a dubious route. After 1968, the award was raised from $500 to $1,000, where it remains today. Other benefits, such as increased music sales or performances, vary widely among winners, although a Pulitzer is unquestionably an asset in obtaining academic appointments. The record of 40 years clearly indicates that the Pulitzer Prize does not necessarily lead to acceptance into the repertoire. It seems to me a most obvious conclusion how enormously difficult it is to pick a winner from absolutely new works. It must be emphasized that it is not the intent of the Pulitzer Prize to honor a life's work, as is often the case with Nobel winners, but only to recognize the merit of a single new composition heard for the first time and possibly heard only once during the previous year. Yet another conclusion is that the prestige of the Pulitzer Prizes has created a needed achievement goal for aspiring American composers who have largely worked in an atmosphere of indifference, if not actual hostility, and this alone may transcend the actual merits of the individual pieces chosen. Speaking now to the negative side, I also believe that criticisms of the music prizes are not without merit, that the awards favor Columbia composers, that the awards favor New York area or Eastern Seaboard composers, that they manage to pick the least distinguished work by a good composer, and finally, my own favorite, whatever happened to composers like David Diamond, Paul Creston, Peter Menin, Morton Gould? And is there ever a chance for our Southwestern composers like Oklahoma's Ray Luke or Arizona's Robert Machinsky? Fill in the blanks with your own favorites. Again, applying New Yorker critic Andrew Porter's frequently cited axiom, is this a piece I'd really like to hear again to the 39 Pulitzer winners? The answer is yes, and sometimes maybe, and sometimes no. Because of a lack of public interest in the music award, it has in the past been proposed from within the advisory board that the award be discontinued. It is to the everlasting credit of the Pulitzer family that this idea has been firmly rejected. Finally, and this too is a personal observation, if the Pulitzer Prize in Music has contributed, even in a small way, to enlarging the awareness of and recognition for American composers, and in so doing has contributed to creating an improved environment in which future masterworks, even masterpieces, can be produced in America by native composers, it has more than justified its existence. Thank you.
Bringing his goodies up. You bag full goodies. Here. Actually, you need to rewind the record copy. Arnold did his talk on the Edison talking doll.